Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. It is August 27th, 2020, and I am James Schultz. I'm joined today by Mr. John Lindemann.
It's great to be here, James.
Mr. Greg Leahy.
Ahoy, ahoy, everyone.
And Mr. Guillaume Vayette.
Hello.
This is episode 687 of our fine podcast, and a little bit of plugs to get out of the way. John and Greg and myself just finished recording a Patreon podcast. That Patreon podcast will go live probably the day after this one does. And if you're curious, Guillaume and I recorded a Patreon podcast last weekend. It went live last Monday. If you want to hear these podcasts, they involve what we've been watching on TV during the pandemic, part two. Weirdly, we did a lot of Amazon Prime Video stuff the first time. Now we're doing a lot of Netflix stuff. Synchronicity. We're not getting paid. And then John, Greg, and myself just recorded a podcast that kind of just talks about sports and being a sport fan in this COVID era. And with basically 2020 just really just reshuffling the deck on everything. That plus our entire backlog of now 15 monthly episodes is available to you at patreon.com/NWR for a single dollar a month. That money does not go to us. It goes to the site to help run things like server hosting costs and the various expenses that come with hosting a website right now. Again, that is patreon.com/NWR. To all the people who are already patrons, thank you for making this possible. And on that, we're going to go ahead and get started. So the fact there was a Direct this week was not a well-kept secret. We were hearing it was going to be on Friday. We were considering plans of moving the recording to accommodate it. And then it just happened before we could make a decision. It was another partner Direct for August. They told us they were going to do more of these. They did more of these. This one had 100% less Bakugan, which I'm upset about. So we're just going to kind of go
Bakugan
through it.
The Bakugan was part of a Paper Mario presentation, not a...
Oh, that's right, it was.
Well, at least, I don't know whether it subsequently featured in that, but that was where it debuted, was a Paper Mario Treehouse.
It did.
That's a separate strand. It's all getting very diffuse now, like all these different strands with
indie worlds
and partner directs and Treehouse broadcasts and things. And of course, we're still waiting for like the Direct that we assume is coming. Obviously, we have had one during the kind of pandemic period in May, wasn't it? You know, with the kind of Xenoblade, right about then, but not quite the sort of one that's like, okay, this is where some of the E3 stuff has gone kind of one. So, yeah, I presume all sides point to such a broadcast being fairly... You know, not necessarily, again, not to get too carried away with what, because I think everything's going to be scaled back now, given the current reality. But, you know, I think more major directs probably not that far away. You've got that kind of some sort of investor relations event in the middle of September, kind of all expecting there to be things that are announced prior, you know, in the run up to that. Obviously, all the noise about a new model of the Switch now. Yeah, this is all these other kind of smaller things. It kind of feels like they're firing them out there, you know, in advance, probably of something bigger, you know, to kind of give them some amount of time in their own spotlight. Although this was, you know, unannounced, technically. As you said, there was chatter out there about there being something, but that was all unofficial, you know, just on the grapevine kind of stuff. It seems now like their preferred way to like manage expectations is to just, you know, just drop it on people.
Any.
Yeah, don't have any.
Yeah, I mean, it literally... Like, I was literally still talking with people to try to figure out if we should shift our recording to Friday. That day, like, the day that this thing dropped. And I got a message from one person who's like, well, don't worry about it. And I'm like, what do you mean? And then I just got a link to a YouTube video. I went, oh, I see. Never mind then. Now, this could end up being one of the greatest RFN prediction failures ever if there actually is a Direct tomorrow that's unannounced and it's, like, the big one. And it would be completely on brand for us. But at this point, if it was the big one, they would have already warned us it was coming. Because that is the MO for those. But yeah, we're just going to kind of go through some of the stuff. We're not going to try to be completely cover everything that was in it, because there's a bunch of stuff in it that I don't think really necessarily got our hearts beating. Greg pointed out to us during planning, this was sort of the rhythm game event of the season. Obviously, there's this Kingdom Hearts thing, rhythm game.
Melody of Memory. Although it kind of looks like theater rhythm Kingdom Hearts.
It does.
At times, yeah. You know, it's certainly, yeah, it's kind of an extension of that. Because, of course, the theater rhythm Final Fantasy, and yeah, there was the curtain call version and all that, but there was theater rhythm Dragon Quest in Japan.
Right.
It didn't just stop with Final Fantasy in Japan. But this is kind of seems to be expanding on that with, kind of more cinematic kind of presentation.
Yeah, it doesn't look as interesting as those, because those games had a style of their own.
Yeah, I mean, they're still there. They're those little, like dolls that are made up. Like, you could see them kind of showing up in, like, maybe little menus or something. But, you know, like, you had the sort of most interesting part about that presentation in Theater Rhythm had to be, like, when, like, bosses would show up in these weird kind of, like, very deformed like versions of what they were actually in their constituent games. Obviously, they're kind of drawing from a bunch of disparate art styles in the case of Final Fantasies, and then kind of harmonizing them down to this one art style that fits in with the little dolls that represent the characters in your party or whatever. But here, of course, being Kingdom Hearts, it's just Nomura, the actual kind of look, just kind of replicated seemingly, which, I am someone who is rather off-put by Nomura's style, I must confess.
Yeah.
I've never been a fan of that kind of thing, and I've never played any Kingdom Hearts games myself, but they do have Shimomura music in them, a lot of it, so... it's probably one of the more kind of appealing aspects of the franchise to focus on.
Yeah, I mean, the music in this series is well regarded historically. And of course, the cutscenes in this series are just complete absolute madness. So there's a certain amount of, like, they're just giving you the things that are, like, the standouts. But it just didn't look that interesting gameplay-wise. Like, it looked like there's a bit more variety than Theater Rhythm, but it looked kind of slow. I don't know,
there was always like different kind of difficulties and things with Theater Rhythm. What I'll say about Theater Rhythm is I don't think the rhythm gameplay was like its biggest strength. Like it was kind of passable as like in terms of purely its kind of rhythm game mechanics, but it's like, okay, you've got all this brilliant square RPG music because Curtain Call went even beyond just Final Fantasy, especially with like the DLC, you had Chrono Trigger stuff, also, things like showing up, Octopath Traveler, Bravely Default, I should say. And, so like, all this great breadth of music, and then it's like these sort of light RPG mechanics of like leveling up a party, kind of, going through all these different, kind of kinds of stages, field music, battle music, event music. So it was more in just how, the music itself and then how everything was dressed up rather than just, these rhythm mechanics are really awesome. And obviously this is something somewhat different, but I can only imagine that it's probably going to be in the same ballpark. I'd be surprised if it blows anyone's socks off purely as a sort of rhythm game mechanically.
Yeah. A game that might blow your socks off, though. The Taiko Drum Master RPGs are coming to the West for some reason.
Saw this. I didn't even know these existed, but I.
So
what is
they
the deal
kind
with these?
Of existed. They were 3DS games in Japan.
Uh huh.
They have been ported to Switch and are now being released as a collection. As I noted at the time, this is the kind of weird shit that I love, because it is. I mean, this is some truly bizarre stuff. But yeah, I don't know much about these games. It feels like it's just kind of challenge based rhythm gameplay. And of course, there is regular standard Taiko no Tatsujin stuff. In here as well, just standard. And I really enjoyed Drum and Fun, which was the game that came out on Switch a couple years ago now. So I'm in for this weird rhythm-based RPG when it comes out in winter. It just the fact it's coming out is surreal. I mean, you figure the licensing in this game is a nightmare in and of itself, because all that music is licensed, or a lot of that music is licensed, not necessarily all of it, some of it's original. I can't imagine what the appeal for a collection of Taiko no Tatsujin RPGs is in Japan. I mean, in the U.S., but I'm going to guess it's not real high. But, hey, this is dumb. Taiko no Tatsujin's Rhythmic Adventure Pack, which sounds like it's DLC for Taiko no Tatsujin, but it's actually a game. I don't know. I'm down to see this thing, this idea. Just Dance is continuing to be a thing that happens. Was there anything noteworthy about Just Dance, or is it just Dance?
Yeah, clues in the name, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, although,
yeah, I guess I think you're probably asking the wrong audience for that.
Yeah, I suppose technically at this point, perhaps it should be just Dance. just that again.
So I guess it was the last dance for Wii. I guess that's what the last one should have been called.
I don't know. Is it coming to Wii this time? Last year's did.
No,
it's not? Okay.
This is it. This is the last one. The Wii is no more. So that means the Wii is officially dead.
Yeah, the last three games for Wii were all Just Dance. It was amazing.
Yeah, it was just like, yeah, it was a complete curiosity. It was like every year, it's like, are they going to make another one? Oh my God, they made another one. So, yeah.
It was the Harmonix like multiplayer user thing that was the quite brief, but it was another mention in the... Yeah, pretty noticeable sort of music or rhythm sort of theme that was going on.
Most of the announcements were in that vein. Moving outside the rhythm, Puyo Puyo Tetris 2 is a thing that exists. I don't know, because now we can continue the romance, the star-crossed romance of Ringo and anime McNugget created for the Puyo Puyo world, and T, an anime space McNugget created for the Tetris world.
It's kind of scary to think, because Puyo Puyo Tetris on Switch was roundabout launch, wasn't it?
Yeah, system a few months after launch. Yeah.
Yeah, obviously it existed before that on 3DS and PlayStation, I guess. But it's just funny to think of that being that long ago. You know, that it's they're coming back to it sort of roughly sort of similar sort of time. Yeah, we're hearing about this as we might have been hearing under different circumstances about like Breath of the Wild 2.
Right, it'll be about 3 or more years later.
Yeah, it was 3.5. Yeah, you know, so yeah, it's not, especially when you consider that the game wasn't even entirely new then. You know, because like I said, it already existed on the phone. It's not really before time or anything. It's just, I guess, I assume it did pretty well.
I think it's one of those things where the fact that it even is getting a sequel, it's sort of when we talked about Mario Kart 8, why it will never get a Switch sequel, because it doesn't need one. Like it has filled its niche, and anything you create to live in the niche will simply just push it out of the niche, and it won't necessarily move the needle any particular way. It felt like Puyo Puyo Tetris sort of filled the need for a thing called Puyo Puyo Tetris on Switch, and yet here we are. With a new story mode, because that story mode was really important, I guess, to somebody somewhere. I did check. There is, in fact, fan fiction about that cast of characters. So I guess this is the world we live in. But I don't know how you sell that thing, because it's not like I was going to buy it for the story mode. So I'm not sure. And they added a couple new modes, but I mean, I have Puyo Puyo Tetris. I'm bad at it. I don't know that I want to be bad at it in a couple of new online modes beyond the ones I have, but
right, like at least you got to face against the, maybe if you went online, face against other people who were buying Tetris versus Puyo Puyo for the first time and realized, oh, I'm not good at this, and those people aren't gonna come back for two. So if you do, you're gonna be really, you know, just against the experts.
You're gonna be sad.
Yeah,
you're gonna find yourself very sad. Speaking of somebody finding themselves against the experts, although there's no multiplayer, so I guess it's irrelevant. Final Fantasy Legends fans in this chat, raise your hand.
Ooh. It's like, a whole lot of people who are like, why, online? And that made me angry. That made me angry, because at least 2 is a good game. I can't really speak for the other 2. It's been too long since I've played 3, and I've never really played the first one, but 2, I've played like 10 months ago, and it's a great game. It's a great RPG.
So I had a why for that, but it was, why does all the screenshots have on-screen buttons?
Yeah, well, there's a we do have an answer, I believe. I don't know if it's official, but yeah, probably. Like, the M2 is not back for this compilation. M2 was responsible for putting together the collection of mana, and right. They did a pretty good job, considering, like, probably the lack of features or things like that were due to Square and not due to M2, who in general have done a really good job with the Sega Ages titles that they've worked on.
Which are also ending.
Which are also ending, yeah, maybe because M2 was doing too good of a job and it was too expensive. Who knows? I also choosing, you know, like, 33 versions of Puyo Puyo to put on as a, you know, Sega Ages collection might not have been the best move, but what
if I want to know how Ringo evolved as a character?
But yeah, so
yeah, they did have all the stuff. We talked about stuff like G-Lock and Virtual Racing, yeah. And there were some that were more out of the comfort zone that they'd established with the 3D
Absolutely.
Ones, but yeah, there were plenty that were squarely in that comfort zone.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of commentary online. People seem to want some Dreamcast games or some Saturn games. Like, why couldn't they just go for the popular stuff instead of G-Lock, you know? And
it was just the very popular Saturn. Yes, I remember that. Oh no, I don't actually.
There are some titles on there that I'm sure people would like to play for the first time.
There's demand for it because a lot of people did miss out because there weren't a lot of Saturn owners.
Exactly.
And, you know, and it has been, you know, a very kind of underrepresented in re-released circles because of its, you know, infamously kind of difficult to emulate nature and all that kind of stuff. So it's definitely there, but it's just easier said than done, isn't it? I mean, it's all well and good.
Of course,
It's a lot. It's so much, like you said, in terms of the cost of these things, it's so much easier to say, well, we've basically done... Yeah, some of these get literally some of these games before, or games that are very similar as they ran on the same arcade hardware as things we've done before. But to go outside of that is presumably more costly. And like I said, that's what was really cool about Virtual Racing.
Yeah.
Was that it was getting onto Model 1. But so more Model 1 stuff, I think, would be the first that, because they're still talking about doing future re-releases, Sega in general, whether it's with M2 or. What kind of format it would take, I don't know, but it just feels like more Model 1 would be kind of the first port of call, and then other stuff would be welcome, but I guess we'll have to see.
Yeah, well, it's kind of moot, right? Like, because Sega Ages is ending, and apparently M2 is not back for this collection of Legend? What?
Collection Saga. Of Saga.
Of course.
Yes. Collection of Saga, which is what these games are.
Yes.
Collection of Saga Final Fantasy Legends, I think is the name.
Yeah, yeah, to make sure to not confuse everyone.
Talk about paying for the sins of your localization down the road. Like, man.
Yeah. Well, yeah, like in the early 2000s, conversations about Final Fantasy 2, 3, 6, and 4 were complicated, to say the least. But eventually we got over it. So yeah, so the Saga games, as they were released in Japan, were released here as Final Fantasy Legend. They were Game Boy games. They were not Final Fantasy, but they were Squaresoft RPGs, and at least one of them was good, the second one. So I'm excited about this collection, although since learning that M2 was not in charge, I'm a little bit less excited. We've all seen the bad kind of the backgrounds, the wallpaper. With the buttons on it.
I've seen like one where it's like Tarte mode and it's meant to be, you know, you kind of virtually gripping this old handheld, which is not a Game Boy. It's like generic thing, so it doesn't really work. I mean, yeah.
It's got a round D-pad, like it's a Game Gear.
Yeah, yeah. It's some, you know, kind of in between.
Well, it's a mobile thing, right?
Kind of hypothetical handheld, I guess.
So that doesn't look great. And the filter that they have, like the colors they were using were very much like black and white instead of the filters that M2 had on
Green.
Collection of
we talked about that, how good it was in terms of replicate, if you wanted it, how good it could be at replicate, especially like the Castlevania Contra collections, like that filter on there for replicating that dot matrix, you know, kind of the initial Game Boy screen thing.
So
really,
so
really good.
It doesn't look like we'll get that. And also, apparently there were WonderSwan versions of these games, and people seemed to say that they were better than the Game Boy versions, and that we should have gotten those as well. But Square Enix is going to Square Enix, and it seems like they're taking the cheaper option, giving us the bare minimum. But I'll, you know, happily give them my money.
It does have it does have some sort of like speed increase.
Oh yeah,
it's kind of like what they did to not. I think they did this back in the day, rather than for its actual virtual console release. But Earthbound Beginnings, like, didn't they sped up the game in that kind of US version that never got released. So I guess it's kind of like that sort of feature, but you know, more presumably at your discretion now,
right? Or maybe just like the what they added to Final Fantasy VII and the other Final Fantasies that got released on Switch. That is appreciated. So let's hope that there are more features like that. For some reason, it releases only in December, but you can preload it now if you pre-order it, which is weird. Because
Kingdom Hearts was another preload now. I think that's November. So,
right.
Especially with, I mean, Kingdom Hearts is one thing, but your three retro, Game Boy games just sitting there, kind of evidently done, all kind of checked and ready for sale, but not actually on sale. It seems a little.
Yeah, odd. Like, what's the wait? I mean, literally, if you can't pre-sale on Switch until there is a completed game up on the shop, it's done. The game is, they could get. This is weird one. Like, they're not going to run a marketing campaign around this game. This game won't have better recognition now than, or at any point in the future than it will now, immediately after the Direct. If you're going to shadow drop anything, this is it.
Yeah. So a quick pitch for Final Fantasy Legend 2. It still holds up. It's more modern than you think, because the game's story is all about people using this these magi stones or whatever they are to become new gods. And one of those new gods is Odin. And when you die in the game in battle, Odin revives you because he hopes that you'll provide a challenge for him in the future. So the game kind of has this... just revives you after if you die in battle. So, and if you can't hack it in that battle, you can easily flee. So the game's actually like probably one of the most approachable Kawazu directed games that exist. So I just recommend it just for that. Like, it's a good entry point, but also like it's got genuinely good little stories. Your party is not that you're. None of the characters in your party have any personality, but the NPCs all have their little stories, and you go from like one world to the next, and it's a little bit like Dragon Quest in that each world has its own little story, its own little vignette, and some of it is like surprisingly dramatic. The storytelling is surprisingly evolved. Like the game does stuff to tell a story that you don't expect from a 1990 Game Boy RPG. And I still think it's worth playing. The first one I've never really played, but I've seen some stuff online. It seems cool. It seems like it's much harder and much more obtuse, but you do go and what's the exact attack and dethrone God, I believe.
Yes,
so you go attack and dethrone God, so that's the thing. And also God is also standing in for like the director of the game for Kawazu, so
attack and destroy me.
Exactly. So that sounds cool. And three, I've played. It's been a while. It was not directed by Kawazu, and it's more classical. It's more, you've got experience points. You level up. Like it's more like a Final Fantasy. It's probably good. Like I just don't remember it all that well. There's the time travel element that's not nearly as, explored as in Chrono Trigger.
Right. I mean, it's a Game Boy game.
Yeah. But it's a collection I'll buy, and I recommend people probably like wait for a price drop before getting it if you don't have, fond childhood memories of playing them. But
yeah, it did seem to. I mean, over here, I think I saw the preload price was £15, which
Yeah, not too bad.
That's not too bad, because Game Boy games on the eShop for the 3DS were, I think they varied. Some were more expensive than others, but they were usually about something like £3. So yes, it's more than that, but they're probably quite a bit more substantial as games than your typical Game Boy game. So
yeah, they'll last you like 10, 12 hours probably each.
A piece?
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's I guess it's a good value if you're going to play them, which I am. But if you're just curious, maybe wait for a sale, I guess. So I'm the one person excited about this. There's a few more of us, like in every thread.
Two or three, maybe?
Yeah, maybe.
I was going to say, this is the there are dozens of us dozens meme playing out live on our podcast. Guillaume is never nuding us right now.
Every time on my timeline on Twitter, there was a tweet that was like, what the hell? Why do they bother? I would click on it, get angry, and look at the replies and see the same few people who replied angrily, like, hey, there's dozens of us. So, now I've got a new bunch of friends.
I think I legitimately was, what the hell, as in, like...
Well, I thought someone was pulling my chain. I had no idea that this thing was... the whole direct thing was happening, and the first thing I see was a screenshot
of... Well, they didn't tell anybody, it just showed up.
Yeah, and the first thing I see is this, collection of Saga, and I'm like, I thought it was a Photoshop. I thought it was, specifically a prank pulled on me.
Because, I mean, look, even you have to acknowledge, it's surrealist. Like, the fact that Square Enix woke up and they're like, this is the next thing we need to do.
For some reason, the past year has been the year of Kawasu, so I don't know. I won't question it. Enjoy it.
It is $20. Actually, you know what? Now that you told me that there's a WonderSwan version of this game, looking at the fake handheld console, it kind of looks like a WonderSwan.
Huh. But it plays the Game Boy version.
Not entirely. But I can see a little bit of WonderSwan influence in its shape. And the WonderSwan, I believe, had a... Well, no, the WonderSwan was the dumb-looking one, wasn't it? Never mind. I was thinking of the Neo Geo.
To your pocket color. Out of the two, we don't. I mean, there were different WonderSwan designs. Because you had the color and the swan crystal. But the thing about WonderSwan is that it had buttons, additional buttons, so that you could flip it and play Tate mode,
yeah. But it ended up just looking really goofy.
The initial one, especially in certain colors, it looks like a bar of soap.
That's actually pretty accurate. And the color one starts to look really weird in some ways, because the buttons end up being, the top. The idea that, there's two ways to hold this is very N64 controller-y in some respects.
Games actually, they did it. You could have specific games. I have a vertical shooter that's all that way. But there were actually games that would have different stages. The Makaimura game on there, Ghouls and Ghosts, Ghosts and Goblins. That had, as a number of games in that series have, a particular stage where you're going up something. Well, in this case, you actually flip it to play that section. And I think the Klonoa puzzle game on there that kind of had a sequel for GBA, well, two of them, wasn't there, for GBA, the Klonoa puzzle games, that also had Tate mode bits. So some people made use of it.
Yeah, I think the thing about the WonderSwan that makes it so weird is how the button layout and the shape of the thing, it feels like it was designed by, no one who had ever actually seen human hands. Because the buttons are very, if you're holding it horizontally, the buttons are very low. Especially the two action buttons. So you would be putting a lot of weight, because, it's a lever, effectively. If the buttons were at the top, you'd be resting the entire unit on your hand, which would be much more calm to hold. But instead, that's where the speaker is. So instead, you're supporting all the weight on just the bottom corner. But what's really weird is that there's only two action buttons in horizontal mode, whereas in vertical mode, there's four. Just is. It's just there.
Hmm. Yeah, that's, of course, Gunpei Koei design, right?
Yeah, it's a weird system.
Very much geared to certain types of games in Tate mode, obviously.
Yeah, it was. But I don't know. It's not... It's not super surprising why the WonderSwan wasn't successful. Like, there's a lot. It had a lot going on.
But as well as, of course, just being home to goodness knows how many Bandai associated games, because
right.
yeah, that's the manufacturer and had all the associated licenses that they could just pump video games out for.
And it was, they sure did.
It was that window in time we've talked about before where Square were not welcome on Game Boy and GBA. So that's why you had stuff like WonderSwan versions of Saga games and indeed WonderSwan remakes of Final Fantasy games as well.
Yeah, WonderSwan became their like holdout, but yeah, there's a shit ton of anime games for WonderSwan. Outrageous number, like 80% of its lineup is just anime. So yeah, if you want to play Ark the Lad on your Swan Crystal, good news.
You're in luck.
Also, there are less of you than there are of people who were excited for the Saga Collection. So,
oh my god, I'm looking at the footage from the Final Fantasy Legend on WonderSwan, and now I'm disappointed that we're not getting that. Looks amazing.
Is it that much better?
Well, yeah, it's in color and it's animated and it's it's much. Yeah, it's a full remake. Looks pretty great.
Oh boy.
Maybe for a collection of Saga 2.
Which we're sure to get. Of,
collection of Saga remakes.
Yes.
Collection of Saga 2 Final Fantasy Legends 2.
Like that would actually get a lot of that collection would have more games than you'd think because at least 2 and 3, Saga 2 and 3, both got remade on DS, but we never got that here. Because the DS was too, piracy was too rampant. And also probably, even without piracy, it's kind of doubtful that it could have sold all that well here.
And they didn't want to bother translating it.
Yeah.
Which is the reason we're not getting the WonderSwan either, because they have to retranslate that.
And all this makes this collection's existence all the more surprising, and the fact that it's coming here.
Yeah.
Very surprising.
Yeah, like I understand your intransigence to people's response, but even I had the response of, like, wait, really? Not to denigrate the games, but, like, what thing triggered the decision?
Yeah.
Like somewhere inside the Square Enix headquarters to go, this is the time.
Yeah, how did this get prioritized is really the question.
Yeah, like sometimes that's the most fascinating part of a game.
You know, sometimes at some point, Kawasu thought, like, okay, the time is ripe. I have held on this for long enough and took out his box of compromising photos and just decided blackmail everyone at Square Enix.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean that's the lair we're talking about here. So it's very, very strange. But I congratulations, Guillaume.
Thank you.
You did it. you can claim credit for this if you want.
Woo.
Your campaign to bring the series back to relevancy. It's probably not accurate, but you can claim it. I'm not going to stop you. I'm all about self-aggrandizement, so I encourage it. I think that more or less covers the stuff that we were going to. That was really relevant in the Partner Direct. It's another Partner Direct. There's going to be one of these every month, so don't get upset the next time one happens. They've already had two. There's going to be one in September. We can probably guess when in September it's going to show up. It's going to happen. We'll deal with it when we get there. But yeah, I think on that, we're going to go ahead and move into some new business. I am going to abstain. I am in the middle of a review game. It's under embargo, so I don't really have much to say about it. When the embargo lifts, I'll be able to talk about it next week. Because the embargo lifts on the 4th. No, I won't. I'll be able to talk about it. Oh, wait. Yes, I will. I'll be able to talk about it next week. So I'll talk about it then. And you're going to see a lot of coverage from me on that thing because it's going to take a while to get through. So. John, what have you been up to? I'm doing this literally not knowing versus when I usually cue people up knowing what they've got, so this will be fun.
Yeah, I've been playing a little bit here and there, just kind of random things. Like, I did get the demo for Tony Hawk's Pro Skater, which I don't think I've talked about.
You have not? No.
Yeah, so I just, I had, I had a yearning to play it.
It's Pro Skater. Like, they did it.
Yeah.
Unlike HD, where they didn't do it.
Yes. So this is the this is Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 1 and 2, but the demo is the warehouse level, I believe, from Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 1. I don't even I barely remember any of the levels, but the funny thing about that game is that, you know, I didn't look at any instructions, and that game came out in 1998.
Yeah.
That is a long ass time ago. But yep. I picked that game up and I was like, okay, so, you know, how do I do this? How do I do that? And it pretty much all came back to me. I can't say I'm good at that game, but I remembered way more in terms of how to control that game than I thought I would.
Well, how many of those games did you play?
I played 1 and 2. I don't think I ever played 3.
Okay.
But I played the shit out of 1 and 2, for sure.
Yeah. And the thing is, like, if you kept up with that series, at least up until the point they went to Thug, like, they just kept building. And so 1 and 2 are the things that are featured heavily in this game, 1 and 2's gameplay. So you, I could see you totally being right at home on it.
Yeah. And I guess I did read the one article that said, you know, their big concern was messing up, like, kind of the physics and handling code because it was written so well. And that's really the thing with this game is the fact that the controls are so rock solid. Like, just feels really good.
That was the problem with the HD collection. It just didn't feel right.
Yeah. And so I guess they pretty much just copied and pasted the code right from... Because this one isn't done by Neversoft. It's done by... It eludes me right now. But they had access to the Neversoft code base, and they just pretty much copied and pasted all that handling code right from it and dropped it in their own. So it feels exactly like the original Tony Hawk's Pro Skater. The same kind of momentum, all that kind of stuff. Yes, Vicarious Visions. And I think there's one other company, maybe Beenox, maybe? Am I crazy with that?
I think Beenox is dead.
Yeah. There's another company that's involved with it. I forget. It feels really good. It plays exactly. I mean, it plays exactly like the original Tony Hawk. I'm curious to see the demo that they have. It's like a timed demo, but they do.
Oh,
have,
no, you're right. Beenox is working on it. I'm sorry.
Is it okay?
Yeah,
yeah. I couldn't quite remember if that was it, but yeah. So the demo is, I think it's 2 minutes. So you can play a 2 minute run, which is more than enough time to actually, you know, get acquainted with the game. But it's good for that game because you play it, you try to get a high score, and then you're like, I'll play again. And then you play again. And then you play again. And all of a sudden, an hour has gone by. And you're just like, you're just sitting there trying to beat your own high score and try to do something. And, you know.
I mean, this is exactly the demo that used to be set. I remember playing at a Toys R Us back in the late 1990s.
That's crazy. Yeah.
It was this level. It was the warehouse.
Yeah. I mean, like this game, it's one of those rare games where it just works and they don't have to really change anything. It's almost like, it's almost like the original, you know, like Super Mario Brothers, where it's just, it doesn't matter if you played that game in 1985 or you pick it up and play it today. You just pick it up and you're like, oh, everything works. It just feels good. It feels good. The controls work. The momentum is right. It's just like one of those games where everything just worked out. And I think actually, I think at the time, what was Neversoft actually working on? They were working on a game that was very different. And I don't think Activision had anything else for them to do. And they were just like, they needed somebody. Activision actually, they didn't necessarily want Neversoft to do the game. They just wanted somebody to do like an extreme sports skating game. And they're just like, here, Neversoft, see what you can do with this concept. And so they happened to make like pretty much the best game out there.
They were working on Spider-Man.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
Which is why Spider-Man is an unlockable character in 2, I believe.
In 2. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Wow, that's going deep into the memory banks there.
So I remember the thing they made before Tony Hawk. It's the Bruce Willis vehicle Apocalypse.
Oh boy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Neversoft is got a weird history.
Yeah.
This is actually the third remaster of Tony Hawk 2. Because Tony Hawk 2X on the original Xbox was a remaster of 2. And then we had the one and 2 HD, which were made by Robomoto, which are a mobile development studio, and they were very bad.
Yeah.
And then this is the third attempt at remaking them. Yeah. Well, 2X was good. 2X was really good. That was sort of the make good, because I think 3 was coming a little bit later off. I think PS2 got 3 in 2001 and the other two got it 2002. Mm-hmm. So they had 2X there as the make good for the Xbox.
Yeah. But yeah, now I will say on Xbox, it feels a little bit weird that this is one of the rare instances where the Xbox, I don't think it's the best controller for it.
Oh yeah, because it was built around the PlayStation controller.
Exactly. And
Sony hasn't modernized that thing. And
exactly. As we've said many times, this is the one case where you do want the D-pad as your primary method of input. So
right.
The one thing I haven't done, I do have a fighting, like the Hori fighting pad, which is D-pad centric. It only has D-pad on it, actually.
That might work well.
Yeah, so I haven't tried that yet. I haven't gone back. I've been meaning to go back and play it with that, but that might work. But
does the Hori have two shoulders?
Yes. Yep,
okay.
It has,
then, yeah, it should be fine.
Yep. It has the A, B, X, and Y, and then it has the two shoulder buttons, and then it has the left bumper, right bumper as the last, like, you know, it has like the six button layout for the fighters.
Okay. Yeah, you should be able to do that.
Yep. So yeah, it should be pretty good. But yeah, I mean, it from everything I've seen, it looks like it's going to be, like a pretty much an amazing port. The funny thing is, though, and I kind of respect it, is all of the skaters that were in the original game, they're all in there, but they're all the older versions of themselves, which is amazing.
Yes, they olded them up.
Yeah, so it's like old ass Tony Hawk, and I'm like, I respect that, you know. So yeah, it's cool. It's really good. Other thing I've been playing, just out of pure curiosity, Torchlight 2, which I don't believe I talked about either. Again, I've decided that Diablo clones are like, they're like the pizza of video games to me, where I can actively play them and I can be like, this is okay. And I just keep playing them and it just doesn't matter. Torchlight is, I mean, it is a straight up, it is even more of a Diablo clone than Darksiders I talked about a couple weeks ago.
Right, I mean, it's the original Diablo clone.
Yeah, and I didn't actually realize it was that much of a Diablo clone, but I mean, it is pretty much Diablo clone cartoony style. I mean, like Diablo 3 cartoony style. And
because when we saw Torchlight at the first PAX we went to,
mm-hmm.
and it was like, this is specifically Diablo 3.
Yeah, it's cool. The one thing I will say, though, it doesn't. The thing is with Diablo, and it's so funny. I play these games, and really, they just make me think more about Diablo 3, which I think says a lot. You know, they make me want to play Diablo 3 more, and they just make me realize how good Diablo 3 is, and I think also almost underrated to a degree, because Diablo 3, for various reasons, just generally got shit on when it was released. Some reasons I can see why, but a lot of reasons were just like straight up, you didn't make this game as grimdark as I wanted, so therefore I'm upset. There was a lot of that going on too, which I think it's actually BS.
A lot of the issues with that game were the money too. Like the money, the economy was all fucked up.
Well, the economy was all fucked up because they never should have put an auction house in there to begin with. That was just stupid. Like in a game where the entire game is built around the scarcity of items, why put an auction house in there? You know, I mean, it's a loot pinata. I understand and make money, but I mean, it's just for that game, it doesn't work. It's silly. I think that game generally got a bum rap. Torchlight is, you know, it looks pretty cool. Its style is much more cartoony.
Which Torchlight is this?
This is Torchlight. Torchlight 2. Torchlight 2. So, and, you know, I'm playing through it and enjoying it, but, you know, I'm playing through it very casually, and I don't really care about it too much, but I like these kind of games so much that I just don't, it's not bothering me. I don't feel like I'm wasting my time. I think I'll probably play, I'll play through it to the end, I think. I can see myself playing through this, whereas, you know, Darksiders, I don't know if I'll go back to that. But Torchlight 2, I can see myself just playing through it for curiosity and seeing, like, where they go with the weapons. I do like the fact that they actually have your pet attacking. Like, you can attack with your pet and you know, give it armor and stuff like that, which you can't do in Diablo. In Diablo, you have the concept of a kind of sidekick that, and that's how they do that.
Right.
Which is okay. It gets kind of old because the sidekick, you know, always have their own kind of story, and like they talk about, you know, they have a backstory and stuff like that, but it's, I don't know. Really they're there pretty much as a DPS add. But I do like the fact that in Torchlight 2, I have a cat, of course, as my pet, and you can, you know, give him, you know, armor and stuff like that, and you can set him to passive, aggressive, and defensive. And so, you know, I'll be fighting these monsters and my little cat just like runs right in there and he's take it. And the thing is, I'm not playing on hardcore mode or anything. It's just normal. So my cat actually takes quite a few enemies out. So,
nice.
So yeah. So it's cool. It's funny for me playing these games because it's just like, I just realize how much of a sucker I am for these kinds of games. Just like the loot pinata stuff, man, I just love that stuff. I can sit there and just sort through inventory all day, compare stats. I can just do that all day. I'm such a sucker for it. You know? So, but yeah, it's cool. And it's, you know, pretty easy. It's not super challenging. And I mean, if you've played Diablo, this is just like, it's piece of cake kind of thing. You know, but again, yeah, I just thinking about it now, I'm like, man, I really need to replay Diablo 3. Maybe I should roll a new character I haven't tried before. So
there you go.
It's like, yeah. But yeah, that's it.
All right. Is anything else you want to talk about?
No, I'm good.
Okay. Fair enough. All right. Guillaume.
Yeah. So I've been playing Paper Mario, the Origami King. So Paper Mario as a series, I like enough. I played Color Splash. I talked about it on this podcast. I think it was around like episodes like 499 and 401. And I just listened to those today again. And I was super high on Color Splash. Like when I was talking about it, when I was starting it, I was just enamored with the world and the writing. I thought like, wow, this game, like the HD really makes a difference. The writing is funnier than ever. There's so many cute touches and I was just really digging it. Then episode like 401, I'm like, yeah, okay, I've hit the moment of bullshit that makes me think that maybe I'm not gonna stick with the game, you know, throughout the whole thing. It was like because basically like the game had bosses that required you to go into the fight with the right item in hand. And if you didn't have that item, you would lose the battle, basically. But then when you lost the battle, you would have the whole shtick of having to load back your save and things like that. And so that wasn't great. And I never finished Color Splash. And so I went into Origami King kind of with a lot of hesitation. And I am, again, bowled over by how freaking charming this this freaking game is. It is amazing. The amount of, I don't know, the attention to detail and the kind of like how packed with jokes Nintendo can make this game. It is
custom attenuated to you.
Yeah, and it is just that was never in doubt, right? Like I always thought that this series was charming. It's not the writing and the presentation was never the problem. The problem was stuff around that. It was kind of the tediousness of exploring or the tediousness of the combat. And so, but again, like I was not prepared by just how freaking charming this specific entry is. It is amazing. You know, like you rescue a lot of toads. I think that Toad has become my favorite character in all of Nintendo's games, just due to like every toad that you rescue in this game has, you know, like it always, every time that you rescue a toad, like it's paid off by a joke. and or buy something cute. And like, there's at least three types of jokes in this game. There's the jokes that, you know, make you smile, the jokes that make you laugh out loud, and the jokes that make you groan, which are probably the best jokes of all. You know, like all the bad puns and the dad jokes. They're the best. And there's a lot in this game. But yeah, like the just like cute touches, like you'll find, like, of course, the toads have been folded into origami. You save them by hitting them with a hammer, because of course. And so, like, you might see like these butterflies flying around, and one of them seems to be made of paper. So you hit it, it unfolds into a toad, and that toad is just now kind of jumping in place and trying to flutter with its hands, but not, you know, like it's not using its whole arms to make a wing motion. It's just like the arms are along the body and just the hands are doing the fluttering. It's really precious. It's really cute. I love that toad. But yeah, so extremely cute. I was immediately won over by the charm of it all. But the good news is that I think that the combat system in the Origami King might be the best that this series has ever seen. It still has the time button presses to maximize your impact, the impact of your attacks. But the thing that they've added, which is kind of a puzzle element where you have to slide these the enemies around within a certain number of moves and within the time limit to group them in lines of four or a group of 2x2, and then you can attack the lines of four with the jump attack, and you can attack the groups of 2x2 with the hammer. Like that actually, that gameplay actually appeals to me. I guess I like, you know, puzzle games, and it's a pretty decent one. I had my doubts because I thought, how many configurations of this can this game really support? Like how many times can I solve these puzzles before I'm dead tired of them? But there's been a surprising amount of variety in that. And it's funny because I've heard on podcasts a lot of people complain that they don't like it at all because the timer stresses them out. I will admit I found an easy cheat for that. You can actually stop the timer by pressing the X button, which it basically has your helper, Olivia, give you a hint, and the hint is useless. The hint is garbage, but the timer stops and you can still see
jerk.
And then you can still see what's in the field. So you can take all your time figuring out where you're supposed to place things, and then you unpause the combat. Basically, you press X again, and then you just execute your solution, and then you've done it. So that takes the stress out of those battles, and it's actually, I don't know, it doesn't ruin the game for me. The combat, like, I still find it fun. The part that I like less is actually the traditional Paper Mario thing of the timed attacks. To like that actually, I don't know, that has gotten old like five games ago, and I wish that Nintendo would go away from that, but they haven't. But at least for the most part, you can once you've solved the puzzles, you can actually dispatch most enemies in one shot. So you only have to do it once, and then you're done, and that's
I've been playing this too, and it ends up the old but time button press stuff gets really kind of de-emphasized if you're doing the puzzles right.
Right.
So a lot of the time the enemies won't even get a chance to attack. So the whole, you know, time the button press to block is
right.
Not really a big deal anymore. Yeah, especially you compare it to Mario and Luigi was always more involved because you're talking about jumping to dodge, mm-hmm. and like, you know, you get like attack patterns that require you to kind of dodge in a particular like rhythm with Mario and Luigi, or even more characters than that in some scenarios, I guess. But like, yeah, it's Paper Mario's always been more simple in that regard, and now it's just kind of a bit de-emphasized. But like I say, it's still there, but it's probably, I don't mind it being de-emphasized because I've only played, you know, the original Paper Mario, I've got the classic ones, but just that and Super. But I didn't have an issue with that. I think For me, the battle system, I really like the bosses. This sort of board game scenario that you get with them, I think is really mm-hmm. cool, because it's it kind of flips the standard orientation of the kind of this grid or whatever you want to say, this battlefield where Mario is at the center of it, to the boss is at the center of it. And then, like I said, you're kind of crafting this kind of board game sort of setup where you've got to get through the most advantageous stuff. So it's like, well, I need to be able to, like, I need to go this way to activate a switch that like turns some of the kind of attack panels on. But along the way, I can actually like give myself a recovery heart, or I can give myself like double damage or an additional action. Or so there's just like getting it to work at all, but then there's getting it to work really well. And the bosses are just quite fun in general. I think the regular battles are, you know, I think it's nice that they're a bit of a twist on the the Paper Mario battle mechanics of the old days. Mm-hmm. freshens it up having them, but I'm not hugely enamored with it. I kind of feel like it's like the bosses are like the real kind of like fun version of this, and then the regular battles are kind of the toned down, like adapted, like, well, how could we make this like into a smaller encounter version? I've not, obviously no idea if that's how they went about creating these things, but, yeah. Especially because, you know, there isn't like an emphasis on leveling up. You know, you do kind of grow stronger because you find hearts that give you more health. Mm-hmm. And Olivia says, oh, I think you've got a bit stronger as well. So it's like not explicit. It's just in there. But that's all there is. The actual battles themselves, it's really just all about money. And it's like, well, if you play it well, then battles can be earners for you. But on the other hand, if you're kind of struggling and you're like paying off the toads to like solve it for you or whatever, then it would be a loser. So it's just like, I guess, how much you're concerned about the money, but you don't have to worry about experience. So it's just if you want to avoid the regular battles, you can a lot of the time, because it's not, you know, sometimes in Mario & Luigi game, even though I generally like the battles in that, but they could be quite time consuming. There's this tension between like, I'd kind of like to avoid this, but if you avoid too many battles, are you going to be underleveled? Well, you don't have to worry about that. You know, you just do with it however you want. Obviously, right. some are forced on you. Like regular battles, you basically get forced on you. But there's a lot that you can dodge.
Yeah, but so that's one thing though. My plan, because I knew that I was kind of sick of Paper Mario combat gameplay already before even starting the game. I thought, like, I was listening to podcasts and people were like already saying like, oh, those battles got old for me really quickly. So I thought, well, I'm just going to avoid the battles. But there's a lot of, if you're trying to find all the toads in an area, the game kind of forces you to fight every enemy at least once, because some of them will hide this little kind of glowing doodad that basically like it will make an element in the world appear that will allow you to solve a light puzzle.
Yeah, so, or it's like, okay, you could search all these different things and it's like, well, there could be a toad in there, there could be a lot of things, and then some of those things are going to be enemy encounters, if you're actually trying to find some of the optional stuff, and like the even non-optional in some cases, but so if you're of a mind to like try and find as many toads as you can, you're going to end up fighting more, because that's when they get kind of just thrust upon you.
Yeah, so, but the good news for me, I guess, is that even though I'm doing more combat than I thought, I mind it less than I thought I would. So, it's good. Like, I think this is a good system. The game, it's funny because the game has options. Like, if you don't want to do the puzzles, you can actually turn them off. It's an option in the menu, after a while anyway. It's kind of the other thing that I would like to be able to turn off, the whole time the combat thing. Like, my ideal version of this is, oh, I've solved the puzzle. Well, the combat should be over. Like it's just a formality anyway. After that, like you basically kill them all in one shot. Like let me skip that. I don't mind.
Yeah, again, I mean, I think a lot of cases it wouldn't make that much difference, like, so you may as well. But I suppose bosses, again, is like where it's a bit more, like, you know, they have some bigger attacks where it's like it's a bigger deal if you block correctly, you know, like they are always going to get a chance to attack, unlike your typical kind of minion battle. And you know, it really does matter. Like, yeah, if you block, then it does a lot less damage, that attack, than if you didn't. So that's where it kind of comes into play in a more meaningful way. And I don't mind that. But yeah, when it's just like, oh, let me just rubber stamp this sort of, you know, Goomba killing by pressing the button four times at the correct way, it's pretty perfunctory at this point.
Yeah, but I can't overstate just how, this game makes me happy. Like, it's really, how far are you into the game, Greg?
Three streamers down. So, a decent way in, I guess, based on kind of the way everything's set up. I mean,
I'm at the exact same area, and I'm now in the water, right? Like,
I mean, that's the thing. What I've been, you know, I kind of went with this. So it was a reasonable kind of a little bit of a deal, considering it's a relatively new Nintendo game, and they don't fall in price here or anywhere else, really. Mm-hmm. You know, so there was that, but kind of went with it because it just seemed like the right kind of game for the moment. So it was a more involved and more of an orthodox video game than like Animal Crossing, I've been leaning on for a long time, but not too kind of a rigorous kind of test of gameplay skills or mastery over systems, you know, if it was talking about an RPG. Like, the fact that it's, you know, pretty light on the RPG stuff and just this, you know, kind of fluffy, funny, you know, kind of Nintendo thing seemed like the right tone right about now. And it's delivered on that for me, I would say. I mean, it is pretty consistently amusing. They're really, obviously, I did play Color Splash or Sticker Star. You know, this topic came up, when Xander was talking about it. We had the sort of, you know, the emails and all that about, you know, what they've been doing to the Paper Mario series and the way they handle the characters now and all that. But I mean, it's funny. Like that, mm-hmm. I mean, the different characters or whatever, I mean, they are vehicles for making it funny. Now, you know, I mean, you could complain about the number of characters that are just toads or whatever, but I mean, regardless of how, you know, what vehicles they use to get there, they get to the destination. It is amusing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that is the most important thing to me. Are they really, like I said, leaning into it so bloody hard at this point? It's like, yes, we know there's people that don't like this, and we're just going to kind of revel in it. The sheer toadiness of everything. It's just kind of overwhelming. But like I say, it is kind of amusing, the little gags they kind of give to all the toads, and the music is sensational.
It is really,
really rich. I guess the thing is, for me, I did play Color Splash and stuff like you mentioned about, I mean, the HD, what it brings to the aesthetic is pretty amazing, I think. I think with the lighting and that extra detail, it's just, it really brings it out. It looks really, really good. But I suppose that's probably true with Color Splash 2, I'm going to assume, apart from, you know, I'm not sure how playable that was off TV, but if it had been, it wouldn't obviously be as sharp as a Switch screen is. So those embellishments with the HD wouldn't have come across as well anyway, and Color Splash had great music too. So I guess, you know, maybe for some people who did play that, this isn't like some big step up but for me, having left Paper Mario off at Super Paper Mario, it's like, oh wow, this is really, really nice. And these like big open areas, like really leveraging the aesthetic, and it's surprisingly robust exploration. I mean, it might not be like RPG in terms of, you know, character building a party, you know, all that kind of stuff. But in terms of the sort of scope and just how much you're exploring, like, it's quite it's on a big scale. It's and you're given a certain amount of freedom. Obviously, it is linear. We talked about like the streamers, which are like a literal line of like where you're gonna go to next. But there is a feeling of exploring this really big world in different ways that I think is pretty effective. And it's pretty much a Zelda game. I mean, it's an action, an old school one, not Link Between Worlds or Breath of the Wild. You know, it's obviously got more of that kind of linear structure of the other 3D Zeldas. But it's an action adventure. You know, there's a lot of puzzle solving. At times, it's almost, like a quasi point and click adventure, except you just hammer stuff instead of click at it. But obviously, not a super involved one, but that's what it is. And it's like, there's a lot of cute puzzles, a lot of stuff to explore. It's, but perhaps if you're more steeped in these things than I am, it's not as impressive, but I thought it was quite, it made quite an impression on me. Just like, there's more, a little more, even if it is like mostly about how pleasant and funny it is, there's more to this than perhaps I was expecting.
Yeah, it was, I literally could not remember why I gave up on Color Splash. And then I thought there's like a repository of all the banal Nintendo opinions that I've ever had for the past 8 years. So I went and listened to past episodes, and the things that Color Splash did wrong, in my opinion, and that that Origami King fixes is the exploration was slightly more tedious in Color Splash because throwing the confetti to fill up the holes in Origami King, that was the equivalent in Color Splash of using your hammer to paint bits of the world that were without color. But that was way more fussy because you had to do it several times, like position yourself just right to fill up the entire space with the color that you were painting with. And so, it was just kind of annoying. But the confetti thing, which is basically the same thing in Origami King, you just like throw it in the air and then it's kind of magnetically going where it's supposed to be. So you just have to press the button. You don't have to fuss about like try to position yourself perfectly.
And so he's basically making it rain. And the rain fills in the gaps. Like
yeah,
that.
Exactly.
It looks cute, and it's generally, especially when, because one of the other like really minor character growth things is when you beat like major like landmark bosses, you get more confetti to like store.
Right.
And so yeah, like then, because every now and again early on, it's like, oh, there's a hole, but I don't have any confetti left, and it might take you a little while to find something that can kind of refuel that. But once your like store of it gets really big, that happens less. So it's pretty instant. It's just like if you spot something to fill in, you just do it. And something happens, and it just it's got one of those classic like hits you in the little dopamine release thing, like OCD, I don't know, something of just like, yep, no, I did it, I made it better. that's good.
Yeah, so it was just like fussier and Color Splash, and that added up over time, and also like the boss fights were just more frustrating, more annoying. Like, and I recounted this like boss fight where basically you went into the boss fight and it was impossible that you had the right item to beat him, and you had to basically like, it was an unwinnable fight and you had to know that, and you had to flee the battle and then go find the item. But if you didn't know that, if you tried to win the fight anyway, you would die, and then you would have to reload your save, and then you would, you know, like, it was just, yeah, it was a huge waste of time. So Origami King,
that's a weird, it doesn't sound very
well. Apparently also like there's like a character that gives you a choice, like it tells you, like, he keeps making bone puns because the item that you need is a bone. They're all, you know, of course it's a family game anyway, so actual bones. But the yeah, like so it's very clear the item that you need, and you've seen the item before you got to the boss. But if you go back there, the item has disappeared. There's a whole story thing about it. And you like literally the item doesn't exist in the game's world anymore until you go fight to you go talk to the guy right before the boss, and you tell him that you're not ready to fight, and then you can like the item appears, like the, you've triggered the event that makes it so that you can go after the item.
That sounds like a sort of older school adventure game than even I was thinking. Like that is, it doesn't seem very in keeping with the Paper Mario kind of vibe and all that, you know.
Yeah, well, I kind of find that it was a regular feature of older Paper Mario games, which is why I was always kind of ambivalent about them. But Origami King fixes a lot of these little things that annoyed me in the past. So it just, to me, like, this is so far the best Paper Mario that's been made.
It's a lot of set pieces in this, you know.
Oh, like, God, like, I was like, in like the shy guys and the tutus. There's just things that kind of
just blow up in ways you didn't necessarily kind of anticipate, different gameplay styles or a lot like vehicles and stuff. Like it just, they find ways to kind of take it to different places and then just kind of play with the scenarios and stuff. And I mean the whole thing of the toads that have had their faces punched out by a hole punch, like, and they create like this zombie army of them with a boombox. I mean, it's so weird, but also firmly just playing with the premise of everyone's made out of paper. I mean, I guess, you know, the fundamentally it's like pretty familiar, like Mario RPG ground of just like some weird like other threat has come in that's even sort of put Bowser's nose out of joint. It's like straight out of Super Mario RPG, and the whole like origami kind of invasion like is a little bit like, you know, kind of the sort of dichotomy of the origami people and the paper people is a little bit like the dichotomy of the paper people and the non-paper people of Paper Jam. So it's like it's definitely treading some of the same ground as some of these stuff before, but it probably is just better written than those. It's more sophisticated and slicker.
Yeah, basically, Karen doesn't play these kinds of games, but she was like, well, save videos of when, you know, something funny happened. And so my Switch right now is filled with 30-second videos of, various nonsense just happening. And it's great. I can't, like, yeah, I'm really enjoying it. I hope that nothing will come in, like, will destroy my enjoyment of this. Like, I hope there's not a BS moment that's coming up and that, you know, like a brick wall. But right now, like, this is easily the best in the series, in my opinion. And yeah, that's basically, that's what I've been playing.
Well, cool. I'm glad you're enjoying it. It's one of those games where I've been thinking about getting to it. So to hear that both of y'all are so amused by it, I might have to make the move. Greg.
Yep, so other than Paper Mario, I did finish off Manifold Garden this week. Yeah, I was a bit slower about it in terms of just the number of hours than the timescale that Saran was talking about last week.
I think her timescale is bogus.
Well, it took me a little bit over like 10 hours to see the credits, which, you know, I'm playing it pretty exclusively in handheld mode, and I'm not particularly good at spatial reasoning puzzles in general. But as we kind of touched on with the Picross thing, it's better to be bad at these within certain bounds because it makes them more fun. Like if you can just see the answer really easily, right. I'm not sure how fun this would be when you're like me and it's not that good at them. It ends up being a lot more of a kind of eureka thing when you actually do get the answer and all that. So and also I've been playing handheld. The way, in some ways, I regret it a little bit because obviously this is, in many ways, you just think it as a puzzle game, but it is strong on the audio visual experience element of it. And I think, you know, it's inevitably losing some of that, with the portable play from the point of view, especially because it's first person and it's very trippy. That has more of a profound effect if it's on a big TV, like, you know, with dim lighting or whatever. You're just going to get sucked into it more with that. And I think it's a non, it's not just like an aesthetic choice for the game and that works well. It is part of the game, and the kind of gameplay, I think, works well with it, because compared to, I guess the obvious touchstone for me anyway, for a game like this is like Portal, right? First person, spatial reasoning puzzles, go. Like, so, you know, but thing about sort of like Portal that's not surreal, is that it ends up being kind of more straightforward. And so you kind of have a different attitude about the puzzles in that, in terms of like, if there was the opacity that some of this stuff in Manifold Garden has in Portal, I'd be more inclined to think, the level design's a bit fuzzy here. Like, it could be better. But the thing about Manifold Garden is that it's, I feel like some of the point is that it is just consistently somewhat disorienting and, you know, not clear always exactly like, okay, where does the thread of this puzzle begin and all that. You know, some of it is about just like it completely getting you off balance and you trying to find that thread again, you know, and then kind of going with it. But I mean, in general, I think, yeah, the puzzles aren't like crazy. Like, again, I'm speaking as someone who's not particularly good at solving these kinds of puzzles. It might be far more apparent to others. But, you know, in general, I think they are pretty well designed. I don't think it's terribly hard to kind of get to grips with them necessarily. But it's just like, yeah, there's going to be some time spent, or certainly I spent some time, and I think perhaps, you know, quite a few people might spend a certain amount of time where you're almost just, like I said, getting lost in the audiovisual experience of it and just like spending some time, like, you know, falling through those infinite kind of corridors, just like looking around, like trying to make sense of like how the, and that's a lot of it's like, there's some sort of order here. There's some sort of, you know, there's never like exposition or anything to say like, okay, yes, find this fruit and make a tree grow because this tree is important or whatever, but you just, it's just shown to you and you recognize patterns and you just instinctively start to say, okay, and then you solve that, and then, you know, you see something similar in the future and you start to piece it. So it's like this place doesn't have like real rules, you know, the rules that we have, you know, of physics, but you get into grips with the rules it does have and try to sort of piece together, you know, what is possible in this world and what isn't, and what it does want you to do and what it doesn't.
Yeah, I felt like I was trying to draw the game out of it. Like, where is the game here? In other words, like, okay, like one of the kind of techniques that I learned was, you know, the concept of kind of taking one of the cubes, putting it down, at which point it sticks there if you switch gravity.
Yeah, it's like using it as
like a shelf to almost like ratchet something up. And so you kind of like, that's sort of like, oh, okay, I recognize that pattern and I recognize that I can do that, and that's a skill that I can use elsewhere.
Yeah, right, and then they get to a spot where you have a box that's got multiple directions of gravity that affect it.
Yeah, so you get this sort of asymmetric gravity thing with the seeds or the fruit or whatever they are from the trees, like, in terms of, yeah, it's like, because they don't respond to it the way that you do, or indeed, like, boxes of different colours do. Like, you know, they only react to all the sort of, you know, edges or sides of the sort of cube, essentially, that this reality exists in, are color coded, and, you know, the boxes respond to kind of one of those sides, you know, with gravity, but not the others. And then you get the dual boxes that kind of essentially, it's like gravity works along one axis for them, but not the others, and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, I think there's some pretty strong concepts in there and some really solid kind of nuts and bolts puzzle design, but it's not only about that, you know. It's not just like this sort of production line of puzzles, you know, because it is more, it's more trippy, and it just kind of, plenty of times I just have a sort of soft spot for surreal things in general. So, you know, it kind of speaks to me on a level, and I like the weird juxtaposition of like kind of very, like, you know, thoughtful, like almost like mathematical problem solving embedded in something very surreal. It, you know, finding the order in something that's really weird and, you know, doesn't seemingly kind of have order like that. That's something I kind of liked about it. And so, it was a pretty quick shot to the end, like I said, for me, although admittedly that was facilitated by playing it in portable mode and not really getting the full experience of certain aspects of it. Like I said, I think that the music is pretty effective at selling some of those moments of like how vast it can seem. And obviously some of that is the fact that it's wrapping around, so it's kind of illusory. But still, you know, you have these moments where you've been kind of going through tunnels, essentially, you know, inside some structure for quite a while. And then eventually, you know, you hit a switch and then bang, you know, there's this weird, vast, you know, the scale of it at times is sold really well, of just like this vast, surreal thing that's like a new kind of structure that you haven't seen before. And the music kind of swells and sells it, but not like in a, it's that kind of Blade Runner-y thing of like, it's grandiose and it's kind of beautiful, but not unreservedly so. Because obviously, like in Blade Runner, the landscape is kind of meant to be beautiful, but not in a gorgeous way, like in a, or isn't the future kind of fucked way. Like it's you're not
bleak.
It's not like, yeah, it's like there's grandeur there, but it's like a kind of terrible, kind of dreadful grandeur. And in this case, like it's not like quite like that, but at the same time it's the whole, fitting in with the whole surreal thing of just like, yeah, you're not quite sure how to feel about how vast and kind of impressive this weird world is. So it kind of, I think it, what I heard of it and the sound design and the music, it seemed to really kind of embellish this stuff and sell it really quite nicely. So I guess it's a bit of a shame that I didn't kind of experience it more in the most ideal set, but it just, you know, I don't know how many more weeks rather than one it would have taken to do that. And sometimes as well, I guess it just helps, I think, a game like this playing it in more rapid succession, because you kind of keep the thread of it more in your mind rather than having big gaps. So it just, this was the way it was going to work for me, even though it has downsides. So, always something I was kind of interested in, because I like Portal, you know, I like, you know, Zelda games that have the, you know, a lot of that kind of in them. Like I said, even though I'm not particularly good at them, and this has got its own very particular kind of twist on that formula, both in puzzle design and aesthetics, and it didn't disappoint.
Yeah, I am just at the very end, I believe, at this point, and you're right. You should definitely not take big breaks, because I played a bunch of it Friday after we recorded, and then I set it down for like 4 days, and then it was like, oh no, I've forgotten everything. So congrats. I'm hoping to finish it up soon. Yeah, it's a fun game. I really enjoyed it. Anything else you want to talk about?
That's me, Beck. I got Super Punch Out for the arcade archives, you know, but it's not terribly different, as everybody, you know, probably is already aware. It adds the ducking, so this, you know, arcade Super Punch Out feels more like the Super NES Super Punch Out once you add that in, and you know, straight away the opponent design is leveraging that. Like the first one is Bear Hugger, who of course is, you know, trying to wrap his arms around you up high. So, you know, and then after that it's Dragon Chan, who's doing the high kicks, you know, right in your face and all that. So it kind of rapidly leverages that new mechanic and kind of definitely rounds it out a bit more than the first punch up, but there's like fewer fighters in it. But probably is I could do all right up until Drunkard Ski, as opposed to Popinski. And God, you can die fast on it, because it is,
yes,
it is a Super Punch Out. While it was more faithful to the arcade games than Mike Tyson's Punch Out on NES, it was still a console game, you know, and it had been tweaked to be more about kind of figuring out the patterns and, you know, the fights were a bit slower, whereas these can end far more quickly, both for good or for ill. You know, like, if especially with some of the earlier fights, if you just kind of get stuck in there and get on a roll, like, you just knock the shit out of them after dodging a handful of attacks, which is not something that's less true unless you've really got the exact strategies down with the console games. But the reverse is true. Like, you've got, if Drunkinski gets a few hits in on you, you are in trouble very quickly. So, and then, you know, it doesn't give you kind of that much flexibility for retry. So, yeah, I mean, it is what it is. I think if you've probably got arcade punch out already or two punch, it's hard to say it's particularly essential, but I just wanted to see, you know, kind of how I love punch out as a series. So I just wanted to have all the games, really, even though, and it's, yeah, not like it looks very, very similar, you know, because it was like the following year or something, so it's far from a big step from the original.
Sure. I did actually have one thing I'm going to mention real fast. I'm not going to talk too much about playing it, but I'll mention it. John, do you have the DLC for Forza Horizon 4?
I probably do. I got the Ultimate Edition, so I'm assuming I just inherited it all.
Yeah, yeah. So it was all on sale for $19. So all the cars, all the DLC add-ons, the VIP pack, which is just a money grab. Everything but the treasure map, which is an extreme money grab. So I wouldn't grab that. Because I figure I've been playing. I had already logged about 60 hours in Horizon 4. For a game I didn't buy. I was just playing it off Game Pass. So I grabbed it, and I ran the Treasure Island thing. That's really just a way for them to give you money. Just to give you enough money so you can buy one of the $15 million or 15 million unit, whatever their cash is, houses. But the Lego one, have you played with it? You should.
I have not. The closest thing I've played is in Horizon 3. They had the Hot Wheels expansion, which was pretty friggin' cool too. So it doesn't surprise me the Lego one's cool.
It's not. It's probably not as good as the Hot Wheels one, because obviously the Hot Wheels one is more custom built to what they're trying to do. But there is something about driving a Lego Bugatti Veyron through the middle of a race full of regular cars.
That's pretty awesome.
But I wanted to talk about Don Thompson. You know him as the host of Timeless FM, one of the radio stations that is a part of the Horizon Festival. He's in Horizon 3, apparently, because I guess he just works for Horizon. John, how would you describe Don Thompson?
Don Thompson, which guy is this?
This is the one who hosts the classical radio, the Australian who hosts the classical radio station.
Is he like the cranky guy?
Yeah, incredibly cranky.
Yes. Yes, he is
your stereotypical
cranky
host of a classical radio station.
Yeah. See, I just have it pretty much on Horizon Pulse all the time. So.
Oh, well, yeah, not surprised. Here's the thing. This game needs to exist so that we continue to get Don Thompson's reactions to things. This is a man who clearly wants nothing to do with the Horizon Festival, yet he works for it.
If I remember correctly, he pretty much any time you achieve something or do something, he has a reaction for it.
Well, that sounds incredibly dangerous. Why would you do that?
Mm-hmm.
My favorite, though, is the revelation that he actually didn't come to the UK to be part of the Horizon Festival. He came here to go on vacation with his wife, and then the festival showed up, so he had to work.
That's pretty awesome.
And he's like, he basically is just like, I hate this. Why are we doing this? Why is it always like this? How do you think he reacted to an entire parallel reality made of Lego?
I don't actually, you know, that makes me want to play it because I'm curious as to what they would do with it. He probably thought it was completely ridiculous.
He has a nervous breakdown on air. He basically says something along the lines of, they told me it was made of Lego. I thought there's no way this is real. It was real. It's always real. It's every time it's real with these people. Why do I even doubt this anymore? Here's some more music. And then every achievement you get in the Lego one, he has a deeper and more personal, like, reaction to it. At some point, he's just like, back in Horizon UK, they saw these Lego cars and they thought it was fake. Here's a hint from what I've seen over the last few years. It's never fake. Here's more music. Like, just yeah. This man's having a nervous breakdown, trapped yep. in this parallel universe of Lego.
That's the thing with the Horizon games, man. It's like there is some stuff in there that is just completely silly. There is a lot of genius in these games, though. Like,
I was streaming when we get to the Lego stuff, and I just poked mm-hmm. my head in there. I was like, we're just gonna do this for a minute. We ended up doing like another hour of an already 3 hour long stream.
Yeah.
And every time Don came on, stop the car, and the chat would just die. They're like, why? Mm-hmm. What? This poor man. Someone get him out of here. So we yeah. need to rescue Don Thompson.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
What I will say is that the reason I even brought it up is I am now more convinced than ever that we are less than 3 years away from a Lego-themed Mario-branded video game not made by Traveler's Tales. And why I say that is because Traveler's Tales games are all generic and dull. And I think Nintendo would not be willing to put their imprimatur on a game like that. What they might be interested in putting their name on is a game that's actually fun and inventive and has that Lego aesthetic. Because here's the thing. That game looks like fucking great on in all the Lego stuff they've got in there. It looks awesome on my TV. Now I'm playing it at, what is it, 2140? Whatever the halfway point between 1080 and 4K is. And it looks great. I mean, it looks awesome because I don't have the world's most powerful video game console. But it's such a cool aesthetic, and we've seen how deep they're going with this Lego stuff already, the Mario Lego products, and how much work went into it. I am now more convinced than ever that we are going to have a Mario Lego thing that's not a Traveler Sales game. And here I'm going to go ahead and turn this into a prediction segment and say it's going to be the Rabbids team because they already did good work. And there you go. I did a prediction. The reason I did this, to make sure it never happens. You're welcome.
Thanks, man. It was great while it lasted.
I killed it. I gave you hope and then slaughtered it. Now, honestly, like I would be really interested in what they could do with that space because it's such a neat aesthetic to actually see these things move around and be made of Lego and seeing, you know, how they have the generic audience that stands around at outside the Horizon Festival, just outside the range of carnage yep. of all the cars flying around 1,000 miles an hour. And it's the exact same thing, except it's minifigures. There's a radio. They add one radio station in Lego Island, and it is that "Everything Is Awesome" song from the Lego Movie, and that's it.
That's
it's
awesome.
Just that song looping forever. And you can actually find the radio station. It's buried deep in Lego Island, in like the middle of a desert, and it's just a small Lego house with people dancing in it, and the song playing. So like you can hear it like radiating from the house.
That's good shit.
It's not even on the map. It's just there. You collect alien energy pods at night. It's so weird and goofy. I mean, like I said, I had already streamed for 3 hours, and then I was like, I got to stop. Well, we'll take a look at Lego Island. And then another hour happened.
Yeah. I mean, the Forza Horizon games are really good, man. I mean, that was kind of the same thing. That was sort of like, that was my experience with Forza Horizon 3. I was like, yeah, you know, I like racing games, and, you know, Forza Horizon, like, I don't know, I guess it kind of looks cool, and I just got sucked in by that game just because it was so, so well done, and it had enough, like, there's obviously things that could be improved in it, but, I mean, there was just so much
to do.
Goofiness in it, and, like, it was one of the few games where I actually walked away from that game with several songs, like, I discovered several artists, several songs from that game where I'm like, wow, this is really cool stuff. And
I discovered I never want to hear Jack White's solo career ever again.
Yeah. But yeah, it's really, that's a really interesting series because it's really well done.
Yep.
I look at it and I feel like there's still even more that they could do with it.
Oh yeah. Oh, that there definitely is, and there will be a 5, but it's probably not coming for a while because they're doing a full 4K update for Series X.
Oh, okay.
And they're still pumping out new seasons every month. So,
yeah.
there. You know,
I should jump back into that game. I should really finish that game like I did with Forza Horizon 3.
So I rolled the level counter over.
Nice.
And then I realized, like, I'm passing people in this game who have rolled the level counter over 3 or 4 times.
Yeah.
Because you get a little star next to your name.
Yeah.
And then I saw somebody who had 3 stars next to their name, and I went, oh my God, they've rolled the thing over 3 times?
Mm-hmm.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there are some people who just love this thing. Look, part of the fun for me is just taking a car and making it into a nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you saw my 3-wheeled drag strip machine.
Yeah.
It's a horrible device.
Mm-hmm.
But I love it.
Yeah. That's the thing. This game, it lets you, like, what I always liked is the fact that, like, it lets you really tailor the experience to be as difficult or as easy as you want it to be.
Right.
Because before every single race, you can just adjust the sliders.
Yeah.
Actually, it's not even at, like, the race level. It's just in general, you can say,
I want the car to handle like this.
Yeah, I mean, that all that kind of stuff, you can completely turn that stuff off, or you can tweak your car to your heart's content. And in terms of how difficult each race is, I forget exactly what you tweak, but you can tweak, you know, like how your car handles, like, yep, in the race and all that kind of stuff.
The AI.
Exactly.
How much control it gives you coming into turns. You can tweak if it auto brakes for you if you're going too fast.
Yep.
You can tweak how much of the racing line it shows to you.
Yeah, but what I like the most is that affects how many points you get, like how much experience effectively that you get from each race. So you can make that trade-off where you can make it a little bit harder and maybe a little bit of more of a pain in the butt, but you get more experience. Or if you just don't really care and you just want it to be easy and you don't want to really worry about anything too much but still get something, then you can just dial it down a little bit. They do it really, really well.
Yep. It's a good game. If you have Game Pass, you should just go check it out. And
yeah, I mean, definitely. If you just want kind of an arcade-style racer that you'll see a bunch of goofy stuff in, then yeah, like
you can have that.
And if you but it has like this sort of like it kind of feigns seriousness.
You can smell Forza 7 in it sometimes.
Yes,
but it's distant. And or if you just want to see a man contemplate his own end, mm-hmm, just go buy the Lego Island expansion and go listen to Classic FM and listen to Don Thompson slowly fall into oblivion.
Good old Don Thompson.
He does come back around on it. He does basically come like, yeah, of course. No, great. You did it. Good job. The Treasure Island one where you're hunting down treasure chests, he basically just complains that his wife wants to keep going on these hunts and his butt hurts because he's been bouncing over sand dunes. It's great. I love it. He's my favorite. He's my best Nuke video game character. All right. Well, on that, I'm going to go ahead and say that's all we've got this week. Unless anybody else has something they want to jump in with.
I am actually. I did start playing Mega Man X2 because I hate myself.
Oh, so good. No, that'll go great. I look forward to your report.
Yep.
I look forward to your book report of self-destruction.
Yeah, I already got crushed by Overdrive Ostrich. So there you go.
He's not so bad. You just got to learn his pattern.
Yeah.
All right. Well, while John goes and learns Overdrive Ostrich, I'm going to go ahead and sign us off. So as a reminder for the plug, new Patreon episode out both last week and this week. It's $1 a month. You can go listen to it. There's been 15 RFN Patreons. This goes to support Nintendo World Report's financial endeavors, i.e. hosting and all that fun stuff. And by the way, people downloading RFN, actually really expensive because it's a big dumb file every week. So you can do your part. $1 a month. You'll get to hear us talk about things. Dumb things, smart things, maybe a little bit of both in this week's episode. Email us, rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. That's rfn@nintendoworldreport.com, rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. That's where you can send us your questions, comments, concerns, thoughts, or whatever. Dr. Goomba Tower fan fiction, I don't care. And if it is of a sufficient quality that we deem it worthy of this fine and esteemed program, we will use it on the show. On that, it's time for us to conclude. Greg, what music do we have to sign out this week?
Well, AG's back with another request, and it begins thusly. I want to celebrate Dr. Blooper achieving their MD. Now...
Oh, shit.
I really don't want to believe that.
Yes, the Dr. Blooper did come to Dr. Mario World. It's haunting.
The request itself is for a song from Mario Tennis Aces called Savage Sea, in which naturally a blooper is involved, reminiscing about the blooper's tennis career, as AG puts it. But I choose to believe that really, deep down, AG is just like, I enjoyed Sakuraba last week. I want more Sakuraba this week.
I mean, who doesn't want more Sakuraba?
He's a little bit different. It was an RPG. Got the sort of synth choir thing going on with, GBA. There's a few games that use that, Zero Mission was kind of one of Zero Mission's kind of allusions to the Prime series in a way, was getting that synth choir thing. This is, the Mario Tennis, just purely kind of cheerful, upbeat kind of Sakuraba version, but still unmistakably Sakuraba. So that's what I choose to believe, even though I have been directly told to the contrary, that it's all about Dr. Blooper's empty.
God damn it. Oh, as a quick note, there are new Smash Spirits. They will be available for 2 days after the show ends, so go get them. Or maybe 2 days. It's five days.
The Paper
Friday.
Mario one, the origami specifically ones.
So very quickly after the show comes out, so go get them, because who knows how long you'll have to wait. All right, and on that, bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
Later.